And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
I have been working a lot recently on presentations I'll be making in October. And the focus of these presentations is going to be, at least this is the working title, Small Cap Value, the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And in fact, I will talk about not only the good, but the ugly things that we know about the performance of small cap value. And I'll be making one presentation for an hour prior to another presentation by Chris Pederson to a group of AAII chapters. And I'll also, along with Rich Buck, we will write an article on the topic for the AAII Journal in October. And finally, I'll have a 20-minute presentation at the Bogleheads conference on October 13th. And of course, a lot of this is going to be about performance. I mean, that is the reason that we would want to put some money in a small cap value fund, and that's because we expect to be paid a premium for that. This morning, when I opened up my email, I saw a title by Ben Carlson, and if there's one thing that Ben Carlson or the editors at A Wealth of Common Sense know how to do, that is to write a headline, a title that gets my attention. And this morning, the title was Everything and Everyone Underperforms Eventually. And that certainly struck home with me because I've got this focus right now on looking at all the ways one might judge the performance of small cap value. I'm going to just give you some highlights from this article. We'll have a link to it in the podcast notes. He says, the rise in interest rates has led to a slaughter in long-term U.S. treasuries. Even when we include the income earned on the bonds, which hasn't been much in recent years, long-term treasury is in the midst of a 40% drawdown. Losses of this magnitude can erase years and years of gains. Now we're closing in on a lost decade for long-term bonds. These are the total returns over the past 9 years. And there's great charts to go along with this. He goes on, this is a new phenomenon in recent decades for long-duration bonds. Before interest rates finally started to rise of late, long-term bonds were in the midst of one of the greatest bull markets of all time. Long bonds have gotten crushed in recent years, but they were on a ridiculous run prior to the current cycle of high inflation and rising rates. In the 25 years ending in March of 2020, long bonds had better annual returns than the S&P 500, 8.2% to 8%, and they did so with one-third less volatility. Long bonds also outperformed U.S. stocks in the nearly 30-year period starting in 1981 and ended in February of 2009, 10.6% versus 9.2%. Most of the time, stocks beat bonds over the long run, but not always. It's probably also worth noting long-term bonds lost more than 50% of their value after accounting for inflation from 1950 through 1981. Everything underperforms at some point. You just don't know when or for how long, plus your start and end dates have a lot to say in the matter. A lost decade for bonds is a relatively new experience, but plenty of other asset classes have seen that in the recent past. The S&P 500 went through a lost decade from 2000 to 2009 with a total return of a minus 9% for those 10 years. In that same period, emerging market stocks were up more than 160%. Gold was up nearly 275% to kick off the first decade of the 21st century. However, emerging markets went nowhere from 2008 to 2016 with a total return of a negative 11%. Gold peaked in the summer of 2011 at roughly $1,900 an ounce. It wouldn't reach that level again until the summer of 2020, pretty close to a decade lost there too. Warren Buffett compounded Berkshire Hathaway shares at an annual rate of 19.8% from 1965 to 2022, doubling up the return on the S&P 500 of 9.9% in that time. However, more than 30% of that time, the S&P 500 outperformed Berkshire Hathaway over rolling three-year time frames. From 1995 to 1999, Berkshire Hathaway was up an impressive 175% in total. However, the NASDAQ composite was up 450% in that time. After the NASDAQ was up 41% per year from 1995 to 1999, the cumulative return from 2000 to 2012 was a negative 19.1%. That was nearly a decade and a half with no progress. Over the past 95 years, cash has outperformed stocks 31 times. Bonds have underperformed cash in 40 of those 95 years. Well, I don't know about you, but I always like Ben Carlson's work. The numbers are so powerful. But there are some powerful lessons inside of all this performance. We are aggressive advocates for the use of fixed income. We see it as the defense against the volatility of the equities market, particularly when the equities market is on the downside. As most of you know, we do not recommend long-term bonds, and in particular, long-term government bonds, as a way to modify volatility, to control, to defend against loss when the market's going down, because long-term government bonds, as we just noted, can be as dangerous as the stock market. On the other hand, intermediate-term government bonds have a long record of giving very similar returns. As a matter of fact, if we look at the 56 40-year period since 1928, the intermediate-term government bond, the average growth rate, 5.9%, versus for long-term government bonds, the average, 5.8%. The worst 40-year period for the intermediate-term government bond, 2.8%, the worst for long-term government bonds, 2.3%. And by the way, to give perspective, short-term government bonds, the worst period is 1.6% and the average is 4.4%. That is the reason that in our bond portfolio, we have more intermediate than we do in TIPS or short-term. Because over long periods of time, the premium is quite large. Daryl Balls pulled off some interesting numbers in this relationship between the equities market and the bond market in the bad times. And he pulled off all of the losing years from 1928 to 2022 for the S&P 500, there were 26 of them, and the average loss was 13.5%. And of course, some of them were very large. As we remember, in 2008, the S&P 500 was down 36.6%. For what it's worth, the five-year T-note in 2008 was up 13.1%. But if we look at all of those 26 bad years, there were only 3 years that the five-year T-note lost money, and two of them were very small. In 1931, the loss was 2.3%, while the S&P 500 was down about 44%. And then in 1969, it was down less than 1%, I mean the five-year T-note, while the market was down 8%. And finally, in 2022, the five-year T-note was down 9.4%. That was a lot, but a far cry from the pain of the long-term treasuries. So there's still, as far as I'm concerned, the need for, and in particular, governments, the intermediate to short is still, I think, the right place to be as a defensive position against the major losses that equities can throw at us, whether it's the small cap value or the S&P 500. Yes, everything underperforms at some point. Ben Carlson is right on. And one of the things that we have to believe about the things that do underperform from time to time, that there is a reason why they should be better in the future. Not just because of a lucky streak. I have no idea why I happened to come upon an article in Morningstar from 2006, the first week of 2006, from Russ Kinnell, or Kinnell, whichever it might be. But he was focused at that moment in time in the return of the Bill Miller's Legg Mason Value Trust, which had this amazing track record. It had just outperformed the S&P 500. This is through the end of 2005, some 15 years in a row. Now, what's fascinating about that story is to see the rest of the story, to see the underperformance. But you don't expect the underperformance when something has been doing so well for so long. As a matter of fact, I have talked about that period that the S&P 500 from 1995 to 1999 compounded at over 28% a year. Well, that 15 years that Bill Miller outperformed the S&P 500, he was doing it during those 5 years. And instead of a 28.5% compound rate of return, his Legg Mason Value Trust compounded at 38% a year, 10% better. I mean, you would be okay if he only beat the S&P by 5, or maybe even consistently by 2 or 3 would be really cool. And at that point in time, he had attracted $11 billion under management. Now, I looked at the chart for the Legg Mason Value Trust at Morningstar. And it started in 1982. So I could pull up the returns from 1982 and I could compare it to the S&P 500. Now, as you can imagine, by the end of 2005, you would expect it had a whale of a lot more money than the S&P 500, and it did. Between 1982 and 2005, The Legg Mason Value Trust, a $10,000 investment, grew to over $373,000 versus the S&P 500, $195,000. It was magic. And it starts to look like it's something we could depend upon. It's like this premium for small cap value. When you see the long-term advantage, one of the charts or tables or graphs that I'll use in October will be the telltale chart. And what you'll see is for every dollar that you invested in 1927, by 2023, it was worth 13 times what the S&P 500 was over that period of time. But it certainly didn't show that it could outproduce the S&P 500 15 years in a row. But let's talk about the rest of the story. I tried to look up to see how much money was under management in that Legg Mason Value Trust. I knew it was $11 billion. I found that. What I couldn't find was how much the S&P 500 had at that time. But I do know now that the Legg Mason Value Trust, after having $11 billion under management in 2006, the beginning of the year, it now has $2 billion under management. Oh, and they're still getting a pound of flesh here. Expense ratio is 1.74 versus 0.03 or 0.04 for the S&P 500. You see, they're still collecting big premiums and management fees because of what they did many, many years ago. This is the way the industry works. They love it when they get a run because people will be attracted, put money there, and a lot of people just leave it there expecting it's going to do it again. Well, here's what we know today. After all of these years, starting in 1982, the S&P 500 has now grown, as of August 18, 2023, to $952,000 versus over $807,000 for the Legg Mason Value Trust. Remember, it was all the way up to $373,000. It has done a little better, Legg Mason has. Oh, by the way, they've changed their name. It's called ClearBridge Value today. So it has had a very mediocre track record. The S&P 500, when you look at the two, looks like it took off like a rocket. And sometimes when you see that, it makes you believe, you know, why don't I just put all my money in the S&P 500? Because eventually it's going to be the winner. And that is likely to be true against active management, because just because an active manager has a good 15-year track record, magnificent 15-year track record, there is no way to come to the conclusion that they're going to do that again. But we wouldn't believe that of the S&P 500 versus Treasury bonds, right? We would believe that in the long run, the S&P 500 will rise again and be the better long-term performer. And my belief is, and it only can be belief, is we have that same relationship with the small cap value. It is not a matter of somebody having to be smart and second guess the selection of the securities that go into the portfolio. There's no way to have high confidence that an active manager is going to continue to be better. You can't even continue to expect them to continue to be average. And studies show that most of the time, those great performers are less than average in the years that follow. So I do think we have to be prepared. And that's why my presentation that's coming up here in October is about small cap value, the good, and boy, is there a lot of good. The bad, well, I won't call it the, let's call it the not so good. But then there's the ugly. And of course, that's what we have to figure out. What is there about a small cap value investment that it's not built to be the best for you? And before I close today, I want to address what I hope is a great suggestion to help you as an investor. I come to you and Chris and Daryl and Rich Buck, we all do what we can to help educate you about a decision path, these forks in the road where you choose between stocks and bonds and load and no load and small cap and large cap and U.S. and international and high expenses and low expenses, indexing versus active, all of these forks in the road, all of these things that you can do that will hopefully make you more productive. And our hope is that in the process, you have a sense of confidence in all of this. But I want you to know that the work that Daryl and Rich and Chris and I do is, when I say it's very superficial, we are not in the trenches. Not only are we not financial planners, but we are not in the trenches managing money for you. But there are people who are in the trenches. And when one of our listeners, Patrick, thank you very much for doing this, he sent me three links to interviews with Eduardo Repetto. And Eduardo is the gentleman who is managing the Avantis, a family of funds. Now, he plays many roles, including the chief investment officer, but he knows the inside of these funds. He knows why they are managed the way they are. And I listened to all three of the links that Patrick sent me. And I thought to myself, now, wait a minute. As I sit here and listen to Eduardo, because I have a lot of Avantis funds in our portfolio, and as I hear him, it's almost like I'm having an opportunity to have an interview with Eduardo, as if I am thinking about hiring him to work for me, because that's what he's doing. He is working for me. And I'm glad that he is. But in these three discussions, and it's important to note that all three, or actually it's four people who will be speaking with him on these three recordings. These people have all known him for years. They knew him at DFA and Dimensional Funds, where he was a chief investment officer, and he was a co-CEO. He has a very rich background in this whole process. But I think if you listen to these, and they're not short, one of them is an hour and 48 minutes. Another one is I think a little less than an hour. The other one maybe a little longer than an hour. Rick Ferry interviews him on behalf of the Bogleheads, and Cameron Passmore and Ben Felix from the largest Canadian DFA advisor, and Ben Felix is one of our truth tellers. I think his videos are some of the best educational videos on investing on the internet. And I don't know Peter Lazaroff, but Peter interviews Eduardo in the third one. And in some ways, Peter's is, when I say the most organized, it is, for the beginner, it might be the one to listen to first. But I think all three of those presentations are valuable. And I thought, I asked myself, is it too much to ask an investor to listen to the thoughts and the plans the way that the person who's managing part of our money is making the decisions that he does? And I think you'll find it valuable. As a matter of fact, this whole process of helping you find peace with the process, I would like to know, after you listen to one or three of those interviews, did they give you another sense of trust, way beyond whatever trust that Daryl and Chris and I, Rich, that we can give you? This guy is in the trenches, doing the dirty work that it takes to manage a portfolio, and doing it with a belief system that I find very comforting. And it gives me a high sense of confidence that if the market itself is good, that his strategies are also going to be good. And by the way, I don't know if you noticed in any of the information that's gone out in our social media, but it is our intention to begin sending out newsletters on a more regular basis. And the reason I want to do this is because I get up every morning somewhere between 2 and 4, and I'm on the internet. I'm looking for information that I think would be valuable for you. And often it's on Ben Carlson's site, and often it's Christine Benz or John Reckenthaler over at a Morningstar, or any of the other like Ben Felix and Cameron Passmore and others who are the truth tellers. I want to be able to pass on more information. It means that I'll probably use more articles as focus of comments that I make on the podcasts. I have no problem admitting that there are a lot of people that know more than I do, and if nothing else, I can do the job of vetting and trying to find that good information to share with you. We don't want to have people feeling that we're spamming them. But that's the plan. We're going to do the newsletter weekly. It will be shorter. It will be focused on the work of other people and the new work that we're doing in podcasts and videos and articles at MarketWatch. So we will continue to beef up our educational efforts. And of course, I'll look forward to any feedback that you'll give us on our attempts to educate you to be a better investor. It's all about you having a better financial future, and don't hesitate to write me with a suggestion for a topic. I struggle with many of your emails asking me for personal advice, and I would do me a favor. I can't promise I'm going to call you. But if you will leave at the end of your long question, leave your phone number so that I can give you a quick call, maybe an ask a question or two. And while I cannot give you personal advice, maybe I can just give you a nudge in the right direction or send you an article. But often, in order to be really helpful, I need to talk with you for a second. So, make it easy on me, if you will, if you've got a question, and leave the phone number so that I can know how I can easily. In fact, many times, as you folks know, I don't even email you. I just pick up the phone and call and tell you what I think. So give it a try. I'll try to be better, and it will be helpful if you include that telephone number. Thank you for listening. Thank you for passing this information along to others, friends and family and associates at work. Thank you, those folks who have sent donations in. Many of you are anonymous, and don't tell me who you are, but I want you to know I really do appreciate the help. We got a big project here, and you're part of it. Good luck.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.